Five Properties LLC. Ms. Cherney, good morning to you. You may approach, but let's make sure everybody gets in and out of the courtroom before you begin.
Thank you, Chief Justice.
You may proceed.
Thank you. May it please the court, my name is Caitlin Cherney. I'm an attorney with the Creighton Legal Clinic, and I represent the appellants Claudia Vasquez and Cesar Tinoco, former tenants of the Appalee CHI Properties. The case before the court today is about the legal recourse available to tenants under the Landlord-Tenant Act when their landlord fails to provide them with a safe rental property. Appellants here should have prevailed against the Appalee's 12B6 motion to dismiss. Dismissal at the trial court was severe and frankly surprising. A review of the record will reveal that the facts pled are more than sufficient to support four plausible theories of recovery. And even if the facts pled had been scant, we know that under a 12B6 analysis, their claims would still be considered plausible if discovery may reveal evidence to support them. Today, this court should reverse the district court's dismissal so that the tenants may have their day in court. The facts pled, which this court must accept as true, are: CHI leased Claudia and Cesar an Omaha rental property in May of 2016, for which they paid $850 a month. Dangerous, latent defects existed on the property at the time the lease commenced, including a major electrical hazard and 30 other housing code violations. 6 months into their lease, the City of Omaha declared the property to be unfit for human occupancy and ordered the tenants to vacate immediately due to imminent danger.
There's no objection made at the time of taking possession, was there?
No, the tenants were not aware of the latent defects at the time they entered into the tenancy.
How does that apply to 76-1418 then? Can you explain that, your claim, a little bit more thoroughly there?
Sure. So under 1418, the landlord is required to guarantee two things: exclusive possession and that the rental property is fit at the time the lease commences. And that fitness is defined in section 1419. And so the district court seemed to conclude that 1426 applies only to remedies available for holdover tenants and ignored the clear language of the statute, which says the landlord must deliver at commencement a property that's in compliance with section 76-1419. So basically, landlords are required by law to ensure that the rental property is fit for human habitation at the start of the tenancy. That's their duty, and I would say it's the essence of the landlord-tenant relationship, that the tenant has a duty to pay rent and the landlord has a duty to provide a rental property that's fit for residential use, fit for human occupancy. If a landlord is unsure at the start of the tenancy whether their rental property complies with minimum housing codes or whether the utilities are in good and safe working order, then 1418 would contemplate that the landlord has that duty to know. They should get an inspection, get their electrician or plumber over to ensure that at the time they're handing over those keys, that rental property is safe for the tenants to reside in.
Wouldn't this claim, at least in this situation, just be encompassed in a 1419 claim? And what would be the different remedies if it was not?
Sure. So the distinction is, and I think it would ultimately be a proof issue at trial, if those defects existed at the time of lease commencement and the tenants can prove that, then they should be allowed to proceed under 1426. And those remedies include rental abatement, damages for willful behavior, and attorney fees. Whereas 1419 really seems to encompass those defects that occur during the tenancy, once the landlord has forfeited possession over to the tenants. And under 1419, remedies include lease termination or damages and injunctive relief. And here, the tenants are asserting causes of action under both.
Are you saying that the claim under 1418 now would be actionable if it was unknown to the landlord and tenant at the time they took possession?
That 1418 doesn't have a specific notice requirement. It just puts the onus on the landlord to deliver a fit premises. And
is 18 more focused on delivery and 19 more focused on upkeep?
Yes, I would say 18 is focused really on a failure to deliver, whereas 19 takes us into a failure to maintain.
But a failure to deliver can be because of the conditions of the property. That's your what you're arguing now. Is that correct?
Correct. Not that the tenants were denied exclusive possession, but that they were denied a fit property that they'd bargained for.
The habitability of the property at the time they took possession was not subject, was below 1419 standards.
Correct. Now, I would say that Appley's interpretation of 1426 would severely limit the relief available to tenants like the appellants when those latent defects are discovered in violation of the landlord's warranty of habitability under 1418. The latent defects described in the amended complaint would fall within the realm of 1426 because if those property conditions had been detected at lease commencement, that would clearly permit the tenants to take advantage of the 1426 remedies. Plaintiffs allege, and this court must accept as true, that those defects existed at lease commencement. Because the property wasn't delivered to them in a fit condition, they're proceeding under an appropriate theory of recovery.
Is your argument then that your allegations are sufficient, it's plausible, not habitable upon delivery 18, and therefore the remedy is 26?
Correct, Your Honor.
At this stage of the proceeding?
Right, at the pleading stage, and this is as far as we got in this matter.
How does the rent abatement work under your interpretation of 1426? How long does the, you know, assuming that it's delivered not in a habitable condition, how long does the rent abate?
The statute contemplates that rent abates until possession is delivered or fit premises are delivered.
So you'd interpret that to be it's abated until possession as provided in
1418. And in this case, the plaintiffs allege that the property was never delivered to them in compliance with 1419 by the time they terminated their lease in March of 2017.
And since they've been paying rent from the initial possession, retroactively they'd get that money back.
Correct.
That's the damage being sought.
Under 1426, yes. Now, returning to the analysis of 1419, I would say the district court got it wrong when it read a mandate into section 1425 requiring all tenants to provide a specific 1430-day notice when the property is found to be not in compliance with section 1419. That's simply not what the statute says.
Is your argument an error of law?
That I would say an error of statutory interpretation. Okay. It's a plain language argument. The statute says the tenant may deliver a written notice to the landlord, and it's a basic principle of statutory interpretation that that word may should be given its ordinary and discretionary meaning unless it would manifestly defeat the statutory objective. I'll reserve my remaining time for rebuttal unless there are any further questions. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Tickett, good morning to you.
Good morning, Your Honor. My last name is Dickute, and my ears were burning from the last appeal, but
thank you.
May it please the court, my name is Mark Dickute. I represent CHI Properties in this matter. Your Honors, I want to dispel any concepts at the beginning that we have any relationship to Catholic Health Initiatives. We are not any subsidiary or any relation to them whatsoever. The owners of rental property have been given a lot of bad press lately, and some of it's rightly deserved. But this is not one of those cases. When you look at this, the amended complaint, first blush, you think to yourself, this place sounds horrific. But the reality is here, Your Honors, that this is a case where these defects were discovered 5 months after delivery was surrendered to the plaintiffs, and it was an exclusive possession that was delivered to the appellants. These defects were not known to my client. They're discovered, and what happens at that point? They take absolutely no action. You can see from the trial court's orders, they did nothing for months except move out of the property and abate the rent. Now,
what else would they have done?
Send a 1430-day notice, Your Honor. Terminate that lease. That's the remedy.
They didn't want to terminate the lease.
What sense would it make to, if you don't establish a guideline or some type of timetable for them, why would you wait 2 months for the landlord to do those repairs?
Perhaps they trusted the landlord to fix the problem.
Well, trust is kind of a funny word in the landlord-tenant relationship. There isn't a lot of it, by and large. What we were looking at in this particular instance is there was simply no notice to the owner of the property that there were defects in it. But yet they're asking you to go retroactively back to the commencement of the lease. That result is more than just a little bit absurd. If you look at the scheme of the whole act,
Let me back up here. It's absurd based on the allegations in the complaint to find it plausible that the defects existed upon commencement of the lease. Is that what you're saying? This complaint, the plausible inferences from the complaint are that these defects did not exist at the commencement for 18 purposes.
Well, it's possible to make an inference of that, but you see, Your Honor, it's the application of the statute in this particular case to those facts. When they're saying we've been in exclusive possession of the property for six months now, and this property is substandard, and in fact, it's to the point in November of 2016.
What kind of items were they identifying as being below par?
That's not shown by the amended complaint, Your Honor. There's simply a reference to the fact that the Code Enforcement Division of the City of Omaha came out and found problems with the property.
And there's a reference to the 30 code violations or something like that. Is that right?
It's just a general
reference. Right, okay. And so we have no way of knowing yet what those might involve. Could be inside wiring or could be tenant poked holes in the drywall.
Correct.
You're saying from these allegations, we have no idea what the problems might be.
Exactly, or when they arose.
I see. And what is a matter of law do code violations pertain to?
Code violation.
Is it a code violation, for example, for a mischievous tenant to punch through the drywall? Is that a code violation?
It could be, yes.
And on
could
what
be a
basis?
Cosmetic code violation. And there are two codes, actually, a building code and a maintenance code. And they're shot through with all sorts of issues. It can run anywhere from exterior paint to interior drywall issues. I've seen it in court numerous times where people assert that there are problems with the exterior of the property. That then reflects upon this property being a fit and habitable condition.
So it's not plausible. Your position is that right? It's not plausible based on the allegations that there were defects upon commencement.
Our argument, Judge, central to that is that there are allegations of that, but they arise so late that it's implausible to be able to apply those problems back to the commencement of the lease.
Is that a matter of proof rather than pleading?
It could be a matter of proof, but I think being so far down the lease, the statutes are simply addressed at the commencement of the lease term. They don't refer to we're now all the way to the end of the lease, because if that was the case, why would we even have 76-14-19? If there's everything can relate back to the commencement of the lease, why do we even have that there? It makes no sense. As I was indicating earlier, the whole act is shot through with requirements that you give notice or someone give notice. There's no notice given to the owner of the property. There's none in this particular case that's pled. In fact, I believe in paragraph 41, they even indicated that the landlord did not know about it, but we think it was there. So that's a conclusion. I mean, come on, that's not an allegation of fact. It's simply a conclusion. That's not binding on the trial court either.
Well, if this is a latent defect, does anybody know about it until it's found?
Correct. That's right. And that's part of the problem in this case. You know, when these defects are found in the OPPD instance where the electrical was terminated not by my client, but rather because there was an exterior electrical problem that was discovered, my client is trying to get this repaired. He's not simply ignoring them. They moved out of the property. They abated the rent. They sought substitute.
And I beg your pardon, and that comment, is it contained in the allegations of the complaint?
Yes, it is.
That the efforts were made?
I believe that there are several.
I'm trying to separate our stage here. Was this a 12B6?
Yes.
Okay. So we're focused on the complaint, I think?
Yes, we are.
Okay. So there are allegations in there of the landlord's efforts?
Yes, there are. And in fact, when they returned to the property, I believe the beginning of February, the landlord was still trying to make plumbing repairs to this property. So in that instance, you can see where he's not just sitting idly by, but by the same token, there's no timetable established to do these repairs.
Didn't your client make a demand that they either move back in the property or they were going to be evicted?
Well, it looked like that at one point there was a demand that they leave. He said, get out. But by the same token, they followed it up by paying the next month's rent in November of 2016, and the landlord accepted that November rent.
Before February.
Before February. Was there?
There was a demand that they either move back into the property and start paying rent again, or he was going to evict them, even though there were still code violations.
Not until February, when a three-day notice was served on. There were numerous requests, not so much demands, but requests that he do that. And I believe there are also allegations in that amended complaint as well, that they were checking with him. He said, we're in the process of making repairs.
Yeah, I guess that's the important question. Was the allegation made in the complaint saying that?
That they made a demand?
Or that your client made a demand.
Actually, that just happened, I believe, in October, but it was the subsequent actions of the parties that kind of nullified that. Where they literally, the appellants paid the rent, my client accepted it, and we're moving forward. The issue of a notice given to them establishing a timetable did not occur until February of 2017. At that point, the property, the placarding had been removed. My client sent them a three-day notice because they're still vacillating about what they're going to do, and we're trying to get them to move one way or the other. If you want out of the lease, go.
Is the property habitable at that point? Can they move back in?
According to the allegations of the complaint, the placarding was removed because the property was habitable, but the subsequent inspection disclosed more problems. This is
So your client tells them they have to move back in, but they can't move back in because the city says they can't.
No, my client says you can move back in, but the problem at that point is they move back in, they pay the rent, they move back in, they call the city back out to take a look at the property, more problems are discovered. But it's not clear from the allegations of the complaint whether they were told. My client certainly didn't tell him, get out of the property now, that you've made another complaint to the code enforcement division.
Did your client return their partial rents for November and for February for the parts of the month they were not be able to live in the residence?
That was actually the subject of settlement discussions about trying to get the money back to them, because what we ended up being is unfavorable position of having people that are not terminating the lease, and my client is to the point where he wants to move on. So was there a return of it at that point? No, there was not.
The settlement discussion is not in the record or
correct.
Suggested by the complaint.
Right, that's correct. In any event, we've taken some additional views other than the notice requirements that are involved in this case, and the court can plainly see that they're all over in almost all of the statutes. Notice is required of these problems to the owner of the property.
Paragraphs 48 and 49 of the amended complaint allege, after written and actual notice, defendant failed to maintain the property in compliance with City of Omaha's minimum housing codes. Paragraph 49, after written and actual notice, defendant failed to make all repairs. Why is that not good enough on a motion to dismiss?
Well, by putting him on notice at that point in time, he's trying to do the repairs. It's good enough to put him on notice, Your Honor. But what it doesn't do is it doesn't establish any timetables for getting these done. With a 14-30-day notice, which would have been completely appropriate in this case. And in fact, I would want to submit to the Supreme Court that this is required by the trial courts in almost every county that I've practiced in. If there's an issue regarding condition of the property, the first question out of the judge's mouth is, did you give them a 14-30-day notice? And this is after commencement of the lease. What they're trying to do is suck everything back to the commencement of the lease and say, we have to go back. And if you look at the statute carefully, it talks about prepaid rents. These are rents paid in advance of the due date. There were rents paid after the due date as they accrued. And there's nothing in the statute that allows you to request retroactive damages in this case.
So what's the breadth of matters to which the 14-30-day notice applies?
I would say to...
Because I took from your argument, everybody's got to do that, right?
That's basically what I've seen in action, and while the statute...
From the statutory language, when does that 14, 30-day kick in, based on statutory language?
Anytime there's a defect that potentially impairs the habitability of the property. That's our view.
How do you square that with the statutory language of May, as well as 1425.3 that seems to say that the remedy in subsection 2 of that section is in addition to the remedy of subsection 1?
That's correct. Well, what we're looking for is if they don't do the repairs, then you may have some damages arising from that. So, but the problem in this case is they resorted to the remedies provided in 1427. They abated the rent, they moved out of the property. That was after notice. So our contention is that 1427.2 eliminated resort to 1425.2. And you're right, it does say that you can do this in addition to that. But simply saying that may do this, that they may sue for damages, you know, the actual practice is, unless the landlord has notice of those issues, how can you sue them for damages?
This is how you read the statutes, is that right?
It is. It's trying to establish some form of timetable for the operation of these repairs, to put an end, to put some time constraints on when they can be done, and when, suddenly, the tenant can walk into court and say, Judge, terminate this lease, or as a defense to an eviction, terminate this. Thank you.
Thank you.
I've used up my time. I appreciate you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Do we have time for rebuttal? 1 minute and 32 seconds, Ms. Cherney.
I would like to respond to the appellee's contentions about the notice requirements under the Landlord-Tenant Act. It's not disputed that some notice to the landlord is required when habitability defects are detected during the tenancy. Specifically, when the landlord is not in possession of the rental property, the landlord's duty to keep the house up to code and to make adequate repairs to maintain it in fit and habitable condition.
They can't fix what they don't know.
Right. The distinction here is that under the 1426-1418 regime, the landlord's duty is to be on notice at the time of lease commencement. It's the duty sits with the landlord to ensure when the keys are handed over, this is a fit unit. Now that you have possession, if there is some deterioration, you need to let me know about that. And the statute contemplates actual or written notice under 1419, but no specific form of notice is required. Here, as was pled, the landlord had plenty of notice from the tenants within the first 8 weeks of the lease regarding a mold and water leak issue, from the tenants' council, from the Douglas County Health Department, and from the City of Omaha, who eventually barred the tenants from occupancy. At the 12B6 stage, it was sufficient that the plaintiffs alleged that CHI had failed to maintain the rental property after receiving ample notice and opportunity to cure, and the tenants may be entitled to damages and attorney fees under 1425. Very briefly, as to the appellee's suggestion that the plaintiffs had proceeded under 1427 and were barred from recovery under 1425, I would invite another review of the amended complaint. Plaintiffs assert no cause of action or demand for relief under 1427 precisely because they elected to proceed under 1425. Even if they had, this court has said that plaintiffs aren't barred from pleading inconsistent theories of recovery at the pleading stage. They obviously would not be able to recover under both, but they can plead inconsistent theories, and that's where we were in this case. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you very much. The next case of the day is In Re Estate of Ryan. Justice Miller-Lerman is recused in this matter.